Hello, Mr. Kim here. I'm now on page 17 in the book, and I'm going to now start chapter 2, molecular biology. Molecules to metabolism is the name of this section right now. Top box, vitalism and molecular biology. The theory of vitalism is a falsified theory, which states that organic substances, these are those substances that contain carbon, can only be made by living things. Now, this is a this theory has been falsified. And because it has been falsified. It is like this, that the study of the chemical events inside cells is referred to as molecular biology. And molecular biologists try to explain the events of life using chemicals, okay? And it is also important to understand that their theory of vitalism also stated that some kind of a vital force, some kind of a force of life, is in living things, but this has not been found either. So the theory of vitalism is an outdated theory that has already been falsified. So next box below it is called synthesis of urea, and it was like this, that urea is an organic substance. You have the chemical formula in front of you, and you see that there's a carbon in there, and this carbon makes it organic. It is a waste product, of course. And it was discovered in the human urine in the 18th century, and they thought that only living things can produce urea. But Friedrich Wöhler, German scientist, German chemist, he was able to synthesize urea artificially in 1828, therefore also falsifying the theory of vitalism, because yes, it is possible to make organic substances artificially. Next box towards the right, atoms and molecules. So you have to know what an atom is. An atom is a single particle of an element. A molecule is when several atoms are bonded together by so-called covalent bonds. Covalent bonds occur when electrons are shared. It is like this, that different atoms, there are different atoms that belong to the different elements. And it is like this, that unless you have a nuclear reaction, now we're in physics, one element cannot change and become another element. And if you have substances that are made, if you have molecules that are made of different elements, then you refer to it as a compound. So, for example, nitrogen, if you look at the diagram over here, has N and a triple bond, three lines to another N, so that's N2, is not a compound because we only have nitrogen over here. This is referred to as nitrogen gas, by the way. Okay, so don't confuse nitrogen gas, N2, with atomic nitrogen, which is only N. Same is for oxygen, for example. You have oxygen gas, O2, that's the gas that we breathe in, versus atomic oxygen. So important to know here is, and this really helps you to understand chemical formulas, is that different elements are able to form a different number of bonds. You have to know that hydrogen has one bond, oxygen two bonds, nitrogen's three bonds, sometimes also four, but then it's charged, just side information maybe for you who are in chemistry, and carbon always makes four bonds. If you see a chemical, if you see a structural formula which does not stick to these bonds, or where there are bonds too many or missing, for example, a carbon with five bonds, then the chemical formula is wrong. It is like this, that there are, besides the covalent bonds, there are also some weaker interactions or weaker bonds, and they're called intermolecular forces, and they basically are also relevant for stabilizing the substance. Bottom box, metabolism. There are a couple of terms here that you have to know. Metabolism are all the chemical events catalyzed by enzymes that occur in living things, in organisms. And it is like this, that it's often like this, if a cell has to make a certain substance, then it starts off with an initial substance and makes then an intermediate substance, and using this substance it makes another substance and another substance and so on. So stepwise it changes the chemicals around until you have the final end product. And this is referred to as a metabolic pathway. And it is like this, that in the drawings that you see that there are two types of pathways. There are cycles all the way at the right. You can see that sometimes the original substance can be regenerated again. So you intermediate, whole bunch of intermediates, and then you have an end product, and it goes becomes again an intermediate, and so on. So it can become a cycle, or it can be chains of reactions, like at the very bottom, where you have an initial substance and substrate, and you make an end product. Anabolism and catabolism are two important terms. You've probably heard of anabolic steroids already. Anabolism refers to when you build up something. So for example, when you make more complex molecules out of simpler molecules, you refer to this as anabolism. And catabolism is the opposite, when you break down complex molecules. So for example, in digestion, we refer to as catabolism because we're breaking down complex molecules into simpler molecules. What is a macromolecule? A macromolecule is a large molecule, for example, DNA, carbohydrates, proteins, they belong to the macromolecules. And these macromolecules are made of, are usually chains of smaller components. And these smaller components, the individual chain elements, are referred to as monomers. And these monomers are joined together by condensation reactions, and when two monomers join together, you make a molecule of water, and then the two molecules are joined. And this type of reaction, where you join two molecules together, two monomers together, to make a larger one, this is called a condensation reaction, or also known as a dehydration reaction, because you're removing water. The opposite reaction is called hydrolysis. You can break apart larger molecules into smaller units, into the monomers, and you need water for that, and this is referred to as hydrolysis. You see that the word lysis is included in this word, hydro meaning water, so it's kind of splitting with water, where you're splitting a larger molecules into smaller units, and you need water for that. Okay, so this was page 17, we flip the page, and we now go on to page 18, and we talk about water. Top left box, polarity of water. Look at the drawing of the water molecule over here and the oxygen part, and you see first of all that the hydrogens and oxygens are arranged, the hydrogens are arranged at an angle to the water, that is important, and the oxygen is slightly more negatively charged than the hydrogens, and this is due to the higher electronegativity of the oxygen. So the oxygen likes to pull its the electrons stronger, becoming slightly more negative. Water therefore have overall the water molecule is of course neutral overall, but the oxygen part is slightly more negative than the hydrogen parts, and this refers to as a dipole or dipolarity, making the water polar, a polar molecule. The fact that water is polar, that one side is more positive and the other side is more negative, allows hydrogen bonds to be formed between water molecules, and now we're on the box on the right, hydrogen bonding in water. And you see again the drawing over there, that the hydrogen of one water molecule sticks to the oxygen of another water molecule. And these hydrogen bonds, they require energy when to be broken. And when the hydrogen bonds break, in other words, when water evaporates, then heat energy is required, and this is the reason why water cools down when evaporating, and therefore water can work as a coolant, for example, in the case of sweat. Now, the ability of water to form these hydrogen bonds is really important for other characteristics as well, and to show you the importance of that, we're now going to have a look at the next box, thermal properties of methane and water compared. And there is a huge table over here. I think it's not so important to know, well, for water you should know, honestly, what the melting and the boiling point of water is. But the real idea here is that in water, is able to make hydrogen bonds, methane, CH4, is not. And this has a significant impact on the melting point, specific heat capacity, latent heat of vaporization, and the boiling point. And if you look, that in all cases, the values are higher for water than for methane. And the reason is that water, that the hydrogen bonds give it that. I'm simply going to explain to you right now what these are. So for example, melting point, ice melts at a higher temperature, ice water melts at a higher temperature than for example, methane. Methane is -182 degrees centigrade. Specific heat capacity is the following. How much heat is water able to store? In other words, water is difficult to heat up and difficult to cool down, so it requires a lot of energy to change its temperature. Specific heat capacity refers to the energy needed per gram of water to change its temperature by 1 degree centigrade, and that is higher for water because of the hydrogen bonds. Latent heat of vaporization refers to how much energy is needed per gram to break the hydrogen bonds to evaporate it, and you see that for water it's 3 times as high. Yeah, that's why water cools down a lot when evaporating. And the boiling point with 100 degrees centigrade is also quite high, so you need a lot of energy to break the hydrogen bonds. So, next box, solubility in water. When I put salt into water, it dissolves. Why is this possible? This is possible because the solute, the salt, is polar and water is polar. So in other words, we say a salt is hydrophilic, it's water loving. And if a substance like oil or lipids or fats do not dissolve, then it's hydrophobic. And what we can see is the following top drawing. The plus and the minus, the big plus and minus circles, these are the plus is the sodium, the Na plus, and the minus is the chlorine, Cl minus, chloride. So it's sodium chloride is salt. And you can see that the negative oxygens of the water become attached to the positive sodium. And if the water molecules arrange around ions in that way, then the ion is said to be, or the salt is said to be dissolved. Okay. And it is therefore, so in other words, substances dissolve if they are attracted due to their polarity to the water. So this is kind of the idea here. So you have to know hydrophilic and hydrophobic, two very important things here. Now, what about hydrophobic substances? If you put hydrophobic substance into water, then the water molecules are not attached, or they do not stick, or they don't want to stick to the substance because they are not charged. The substance is not charged. Page 18, the next one on the left, on the right, transport in blood. Blood, of course, the blood plasma is made mostly of water, and this has some important properties because of also for the transport of substances. So let's have a look. Sodium chloride is directly transported in the blood plasma because it's soluble, and it's transported in the form of sodium and chloride ions. The next one is glucose and amino acids are also polar, and they can also be directly dissolved in the plasma. But oxygen is nonpolar. And oxygen does not dissolve very well in water, as you probably all know. That's why we cannot breathe underwater, because the water is not able to dissolve oxygen very well. And therefore, we need hemoglobin to carry and to transport the oxygen. So it needs some help. And cholesterols and fats are really a nonpolar. And they also do not like to dissolve in the blood plasma. And therefore, they have to be transported in small droplets. And these droplets are called lipoproteins. So you have a little things that are non-polar, hydrophobic on the inside. So the fat is on the inside, and on the outside, these lipoproteins, they have a polar surrounding. So with phospholipids and so on, so that they can the whole droplet can be dissolved in the blood. But on the inside, it's oily and fatty, and hydrophobic. On the outside, it's hydrophilic, and that's how fats are transported in the blood, because otherwise they would not directly dissolve. So, page 19, water and life, the ability to form hydrogen bonds of water has a significant impact on certain properties. I'm just simply going to tell you what they are. So in the table, top on page 19, it says cohesive, adhesive, thermal and solvent properties. Many of these you already know. Cohesive properties are that water molecules are able to stick to other water molecules. Of course, you know that because of hydrogen bonds. Adhesive properties is that water likes to stick to non-water, like for example water sticking to a window pane. And both of them, adhesion and cohesion, are important for so-called capillary action, that water is able to move up a plant passively to supply the leaves with water. Thermal properties refers to the fact that water has relatively high boiling and melting points. And also has a high latent heat of vaporization, so that means when the water evaporates, it requires a lot of heat, and it's a high specific heat capacity, which means that it's very it takes a lot of energy to change the temperature of water, and this is relevant because it stabilizes the temperature on Earth. Planets that do not have water in the atmosphere tend to be very hot on the sunny side and very cold on the shadow side. But luckily on Earth, because of large oceans and because of a lot of water in the air, this is stabilized out. And solvent, it means the following: water is a very good solvent due to its polarity, especially for other polar substances. And yes, that's it. Okay. Next point on page 19, condensation reactions. What you see, let's have I already mentioned that macromolecules are made by joining together monomers. And if you join two monomers together, you make a dimer. And if you join another monomer to it, you have a trimer. And then if you join many monomers together, you have a so-called a polymer. So polymer, the word polymer, says nothing more than a long chain of something. For example, a protein, let's say, or polypeptide is a polymer of amino acids. We're going to have a look right now. You over here in the in the middle of the box, you see the chemical formulas of two amino acids. And there's an arrow over here, and you make a so-called a dipeptide. And a dipeptide is two amino acids joined together. And in this process, you form a so-called a peptide bond, and you form a water molecule. Please notice that the word di means two. And in a dipeptide, you have two amino acids, but you make one peptide bond. So for example, what are some other examples of monomers and polymers? Carbohydrates, for example, starch and cellulose, are long chains of glucose. Glucose are the monomers. Then you have a polysaccharide like starch and cellulose and glycogen. They are polysaccharides and they are the so-called the polymers. If you join two monomers together, like for example two glucose molecules together, you make a disaccharide, which is a dimer. What about fatty acids? They can also be linked together to make so-called glycerides. And here it is like this, that you have three fatty acids joined with one glycerol molecule to make a triglyceride. Now, in a lipid molecule, a fat molecule, is a triglyceride, and we do not refer to this as a polymer. Next box, page 19, hydrolysis reactions. So let's have a look here. If you have polypeptides in water, during digestion, you make dipeptides or amino acids. So you split a macromolecule, you split a polymer up into smaller smaller sections. You need water, of course, and you make dipeptides. If you have a polysaccharide, you can break it down to disaccharides or monosaccharides. The disaccharides are the dimers, the monosaccharides are the monomers. And you have glycerides, for example, triglycerides, fat molecules, and water, you make fatty acids, two or three, depending on whether it's the fat lipid contains two or three fatty acids, and glycerol. Triglycerides, of course, contains three fatty acids, but a so-called a phospholipid in the membrane only contains two fatty acids, just for your information. So we flip the page, page 20, and now we're going to have a look at the chemicals, the structural formula of some important carbohydrates here. Top box, monosaccharides. We'll look directly now at the structural formula of ribose. We're going to be looking at ribose and glucose as two monosaccharides. You have to know the chemical formula. Ribose is C5H10O5. Count the number of carbons. If in a multiple choice question, if they ask you which one of them is glucose, you must know there must be six carbons there. Count the glucose, count the carbons. Okay, and for ribose, you have to have five carbons. The thing is now the following. You will see over here a structural formula of ribose, and you see it's a ring shaped structure. At the very top there's an oxygen over here. You see that each carbon has four bonds. As always, you see there are OH groups attached. The O's have two bonds. One of the bonds is always indicated by a line, and the bond to the H, for reasons of short writing, you do not draw a line between an O and the H. Because if you write OH, then you already know that the O is bonded to the H. No need to draw an extra line here. But the oxygen still has two bonds. Okay. And what we do now is the following. You have to be able to, you see, please have a look, that if you start at the very top, where there is the oxygen, it says here a ring of atoms, all of which are carbon and a part of from one oxygen. That is how it's labeled. At the very top, there's an oxygen. And if you move now to the right and go clockwise, you will see a carbon. And that's carbon number one. Then you go further down. On the bottom right, you have carbon number two. On the bottom left, you have carbon number three, and so forth. And carbon number five can be found outside of the ring. Okay? And it's a CH2OH group. That is ribose. And please notice, it only contains carbon, hydrogens, and oxygens. And it is also important, no other elements. Sometimes in multiple choice questions, they add some other stuff to it, to the ring, and ask you if this is ribose or not. So we move further down to glucose, and there are two in the box monosaccharides. We're still, and it says alpha D glucose and beta D glucose, and they are basically have the same chemical formula. And the thing is, the only difference between the alpha D glucose and the beta D glucose is at carbon number one. That's the rightmost carbon from the oxygen. The OH group in the alpha D glucose, the OH group points downwards, and in the OH group on the alpha D glucose points upwards. And the thing is the following, that if you put glucose into water, then glucose will automatically form both of these forms, okay, alpha D glucose and beta D glucose. Okay. The reason why we're telling you this is because it's really important for later on when we make polysaccharides. And that is now the next one. That's the big box on the right side. We talk about polysaccharides now. And over here, you have the structural formula of glucose again, and here the carbons are numbered, right? And at carbon number one, you see that in this case, the OH group points downwards. So that is alpha-D-glucose, where the OH points downwards, okay? So now, we now look at polysaccharides, the three polysaccharides that you have to know, cellulose, starch, and glycogen, and all of them are made of long chains of glucose. In the case of cellulose, cellulose are long unbranched chains or polymers of beta D glucose. That's the one where the OH group is pointing upwards. Okay, and the thing is now the following, that the OH group, which is pointing upwards of carbon one, so maybe you want to follow along in the drawing here at the top, is bonded of carbon one. The problem here that the one in the polysaccharides box here, the OH group is pointing downwards because it's alpha D glucose. But in the case of beta D glucose, the OH group is pointing upwards. And it has to link now to the OH group of carbon four of the next glucose molecule. So it has to link to the OH group of the one which is pointing downwards, because the OH group of carbon four is pointing downwards. So that is the thing why the OH group of carbon one is pointing upwards, and the next OH group of the next glucose is pointing downwards. So it has to make this, it's kind of difficult to make the bond, and therefore the whole glucose molecule has to be flipped around. And this is the reason why if you look in the section 6.1 cellulose here, you will see that the glucoses are always flipped up and down. So just highlight the CH2OH group, and the of each glucose, and then we will see it's pointing downwards, it's pointing upwards, it's pointing downwards, it's pointing upwards, and so on. Yeah, and that is that's cellulose. Yeah, and the glucoses are always flipped around because of this bond. The second one is starch, and starch is alpha D glucose, and it is like this that it is also branched. And you now can see that in the chemical formula down here that the CH2OH is, they're always pointing to one direction. Okay, that's the first thing, and it is also important for you to understand that it's branched, and there is from carbon number six, there is also, it's also connected to another chain going upwards. So look at carbon number six in the chain, yeah, and you see that there is a line going up, and there is a new glucose chain starting. Okay, starch, there are two forms of starch, amylose and amylopectin. And it says your amylose has only 1-4 linkages. So this means that if you have a single chain of glucose with carbon 1 being bonded to carbon 4 of the next glucose, then that's referred to amylose, and it's unbranched. And if you have amylopectin, then it's branched just like in the drawing that you see over here, because from carbon 6 to carbon 1, sometimes there are also branches. Now, what about glycogen? Glycogen is made by the liver. It's also referred to as animal starch, and it is similar to amylopectin. It is also branched, okay? But there are more 1-6 linkages. So that it was carbohydrates. No, it was not. Disaccharides, box on the bottom left. Simply memorize this. Glucose plus glucose gives you a disaccharide called maltose. This is a condensation reaction or dehydration reaction, and you make therefore water. Glucose and galactose makes lactose. Galactose is a monosaccharide. Glucose and fructose is fruit sugar, makes sucrose, and sucrose, that's a regular table sugar. Okay, so the term sugar that we use in biology, of course, has a slightly wider meaning than in everyday life. The table sugar that we're using is sucrose. Page 21. Molecular visualization of polysaccharides. That's simply telling you that you should use computer models or computers to visualize how these things look like. And this is a so-called ball and stick model, and each ball over there is an atom, and the sticks refer to the bonds. And you can and the idea here is to so that you understand that carbohydrates or molecules are three-dimensional structures and not simply flat like drawn in the book. Okay. So that's molecular visualization software and hydrogen bonding in cellulose. If you look very closely right now in very detail, you're going to see that on page 21 in the bottom, that some of the bonds are dotted lines. You got to look very carefully, and these dotted lines are hydrogen bonds. Yeah, and the non-dotted lines, these are covalent bonds. Okay, so that is supposed to be cellulose, and you can see the different polymers of cellulose are joined together or bonded together over hydrogen bonds. And that's already pretty much it. Okay, so this was page 21. We flip page and we move on to lipids. And in the case of lipids, you have to understand that there are different types of lipids. We've got triglycerides, the phospholipids, and the steroids. And I'm going to give you now a very brief overview over the different structures of these lipids. Triglycerides are fat molecules, and they have one glycerol bonded to three fatty acids. You have at the very top over here, you have a drawing of a glycerol molecule, and you can see that it contains three carbons and three OH groups, and one fatty acid is connected to every OH group. The relatively complex looking drawing below the glycerol, that is a triglyceride, and you see those zigzaggy lines, and these zigzaggy lines are the fatty acids, and every corner is a carbon. Okay, now that's a triglyceride because there's three fatty acids connected to it. For the bottom one is a so-called a phospholipid, and you can now see that there are two fatty acids connected to it on the left side, but there is also now a phosphate group taking the place of the third fatty acid. Okay, so that's the second one. Triglycerides have three fatty acids. Phospholipids are, strictly speaking, diglycerides. And at the very bottom, you have testosterone, which looks completely different. But you have to understand that it's a four-ring structure. You don't have to be able to draw it, but you have to be able to recognize it. And the reason why it's called a lipid is because it's hydrophobic as well, just like the other lipids are, even though its structural formula is very different. Four rings, okay? And steroids are, several hormones are steroids. So, drawing fatty acids, top right, you see over here that there is on the right side a long chain of carbons, and this is an example of a saturated fatty acid because it contains the maximum number of hydrogens. It's saturated with hydrogens. Important is the following, that on one end of the fatty acid you have a COOH group, that's an acid group. There is also a short way of writing this, and it's also indicated over here, COOH, then open parenthesis CH2, close parenthesis N, where the N refers to the number of CH2 groups, and then at the very end you have a CH3. Edible fatty acids are those that you can eat, have an even number of carbon atoms. So, types of fatty acids, we now move down into the next box. They're saturated and unsaturated fatty acids, and then they can be further subdivided. Saturated fatty acids are those that, as I already mentioned, contain the maximum number of hydrogens. And unsaturated fatty acids, they contain double bonds between the carbons. And if there's a double bond, then you cannot add additional hydrogens here. Okay, so unsaturated fatty acids, they contain one or more double bonds. Now, with every double bond, there is now the possibility so a monounsaturated fatty acid only has one double bond, and a polyunsaturated fatty acid has two or more double bonds. Now, if you look at the double bond over here, then you can see that the hydrogens and the chain, they can either be now point into the same direction or into the opposite direction. And if in the case of a cis unsaturated fatty acid, the hydrogen atoms are bonded in such a way that they are can be found on the same side. So the drawing of the fatty acid here, you see that the hydrogens are on opposite sides. So it's a trans fatty acid. So trans means that the hydrogens are on the opposite side of the double bond, and on cis it means that the hydrogens are on the same side. So finished with that, page 23 is the next one that I'm going to talk about. Energy storage. Very briefly, you should know that fats and oils and lipids contain approximately 2 times the energy of carbohydrates or proteins. Okay, and one of the reasons is a significant reason. So for any long-term energy storage, lipids have a higher energy density and are therefore more efficient. Okay, so what about the body mass index? I'm going to explain you how you can read it off here. There is a formula over here which you should memorize. If you have a ruler and if you know your own mass, then you indicate your own mass on the left scale. So for example, if you have a mass of 65 kilograms, then you mark the point 65. If you have a height of, let's say, 170 centimeters, then you mark 170 centimeters. You connect the two dots, and there where the line crosses the body mass index scale, this is your body mass index. Also possible to calculate it. So, health risks of trans fats and saturated fatty acids on the bottom of page 23. You already know what trans fatty acids are, and they are linked, they're unhealthy and have been linked to coronary heart disease. So what this means is the following is that many years ago, the scientists saw it was actually proposed that unsaturated fatty acids are healthier, but now with more evidence, it actually shows it's not, they're not automatically more healthier. It depends on which ones they are, because the trans fats are actually more unhealthy and they have been linked to heart disease. And the saturated fatty acids, they occur naturally and in animal fats and some vegetable oils. And they have also been found to increase, too much high increase in saturated fats have also been found to increase heart problems, coronary heart disease. And for this reason, it says, okay, then we convert some of the saturated fats into unsaturated fats to make them healthier. But actually, it made the situation not better, because some of these unsaturated fats were trans fats, which were also unhealthy. So that's basically it. Yeah, it says here, evaluation of evidence. Science progresses, and with more scientific evidence, we are become more aware of the health risks of certain types of food. So this was basically page 23 right now, and I'm going to stop now with that, and I'm going to continue to talk in the next audio session with proteins, and I'm going to continue in the next audio with page 24.